From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. What happens when a longtime labor and racial justice activist and author writes a work of fiction? You get a page-turner woven through with powerful political analysis. That's what Bill Fletcher Jr.'s debut novel, The Man Who Fell from the Sky, offers. In this murder mystery set in the 1970s, Fletcher weaves an intriguing tale of a Cape Verdean American journalist named David Gomez, who attempts to unravel a case and thereby delves into his own family history and the racial complexities that exist within societies. Actor and activist Danny Glover praised the novel, saying, "Bill Fletcher pulls together history and mystery to create an exciting and compelling story of race and revenge. It is truly an unexpected page-turner." Bill Fletcher Jr. is the former president of Trans-Africa Forum, senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies, an editorial board member of BlackCommentator.com. His nonfiction books include They're Bankrupting Us and 20 Other Myths About Unions and Reimagining Labor Unions, Busting Myths, Building Movements, and Solidarity Divided, The Crisis in Organized Labor and a New Path Towards Social Justice. He joins me to discuss his new book and first novel, The Man Who Fell from the Sky. Welcome to the program, Bill.
Thank you, Sonali. I'm glad to be on the program.
So we've had you on our show many times in the past talking about current political events. Today we discuss your first work of fiction. Why did you think to write a book? What compelled you to take on such a project?
You know, there were several things. One of the things that I usually say is that we all have stories to tell. And I had a story. I had been working through the story for several years. And then with the support and prodding from my wife and my daughter, I decided to actually write it. But you know, the interesting thing that I have found since the book came out, is that a lot of people have stories to tell. And very creative, but they are reticent, they hold back. They don't think that they're capable of doing it. And so I have found myself on a mission of encouraging people to write. And that goes to the second point, which is that through fiction, there's an amazing amount of politics that you can discuss in ways that isn't like hitting people over the head. And I decided I would take a crack at it.
So in a way, this is a cultural entrance into discussing politics.
Exactly, exactly.
Which is a very powerful way to do it, of course. Let's talk about the plot of the book. Your protagonist is an immigrant, basically, right? A Cape Verdean journalist or one with immigrant roots. Why did you
with immigrant roots?
Immigrant roots.
Well, okay. So the main character is a guy named David Gomes, and he is a Cape Verdean American journalist, as you mentioned. I became interested in Cape Verdeans back in the 60s, before I knew that they were Cape Verdeans. So background, Cape Verde is an archipelago about 500 miles off the coast of Senegal. It's part of Africa. And Cape Verdeans were the first African population post 1492 to come to North America voluntarily. And they came as whalers and fishermen. Cape Verde was controlled by Portugal at the time. And so they came, they were Portuguese speaking largely, they were Catholic. They did not necessarily identify with the African Americans that they encountered. Now I got to know Cape Verdeans in the 1960s when I visited Cape Cod, Massachusetts on vacation with my family. And as strange as it may sound, you know, the way I looked at them was that they were just black people with strange names. And they had names that I was unfamiliar with, like Montero or Deleuze or Gomes, Fonseca.
So Portuguese.
Exactly. But it didn't really register with me that they had a different heritage. And then, but I knew that there was something different. And then over time, I began to read about Cape Verde and about Cape Verdeans and discovered that they had this very interesting history that was often overlooked, that they often were either collapsed into the rest of Black America, or they were sometimes collapsed under Portuguese. And they are a Black population, but their identity was an issue and has been for a long time. So I situated the book at an interesting moment, 1970, when, as a result of both the Cape Verdean and Guinea-Bissau struggle for national liberation against Portugal and the Black Freedom Movement, the consciousness of Cape Verdean Americans was beginning to change. And so my story has a lot to do with that and issues of discovery.
So the story is not set in contemporary United States. It's in the 1970s, and the Vietnam War is a backdrop for that. This, I'm assuming, is also this is something from your personal experience. You were an anti-war activist at that time as well.
Correct. I was young in 1970. I'm still young, but I
I
was really
was about
quite
to
young
say
in
that, but you
1970.
jumped
Oh,
the
you're very good. Thank you.
gun.
But I was active. I became active when I was about 15, and so I was very much a part of the anti-Vietnam War efforts. I was very close to the Black Panther Party, and when I was thinking about this particular moment, in part because of, well, actually for a few reasons. One was that I tie the story to an incident in World War II. And so I didn't want to go too far from World War II when this is actually unfolding. The second thing is that many of the characters in the book are veterans. They're either veterans of World War II or veterans of Vietnam. And I thought that it was important, with particularly one of the characters, that you get a sense of how the Vietnam War had an effect on him. And how unsettled he was by the whole experience, having volunteered to go. And so, yes, it was looking at that period, but also it's a very tumultuous period. And many people today don't realize unless you live through it, how tumultuous the so-called 60s and early 70s were. And so I try to introduce a little bit of that.
I'm wondering, Bill, if you might be able to read a section from the book for our audience.
Yeah, well, there's a number of things that I could read, but let me just start here. Actually in the very beginning. And it starts it takes place in Osterville, Massachusetts, which is a part of Cape Cod. And the one of the characters, a white contractor, is on his way to work, and he kisses his wife goodbye. As TJ headed to his truck, Margie, his wife, went downstairs to put a load of clothes in the washing machine. She looked at the clock and realized that she needed to check on Frank to make sure he was up and ready to eat something. Although school was over, he had secured a job until he started with the Coast Guard. When Margie returned to the first floor from the basement, she went over to the kitchen sink where she could look through a window and see a corner of the driveway. She noticed that TJ's truck was still sitting in the driveway, which was odd unless he was sitting there writing up some notes. She didn't hear the engine running. The only sounds she could hear were birds and the occasional car passing by. Curious about what could be holding TJ up, she walked outside. Turning the corner on the walkway that led from the driveway to the house, she stopped. In fact, everything seemed to stop. Margie could not see TJ's head from where she was standing. He seemed to be leaning over to his right toward the passenger's side of the truck. What she could see was shattered glass and jagged edges of what remained of the driver's side window. As she inched closer, her heart pounding. Nothing got any better. When she opened the driver's side door, she found TJ lying on the passenger seat with part of his head blown off. Marjorie Smith's scream pierced the air, startling the birds into flight. That's how the story begins.
So you set the stage with, as all sort of classic murder mysteries do, just going right into a violent act that then you spend the rest of the book sort of peeling back the layers through the eyes of a journalist. Now, a lot of sort of noir mysteries have a detective at the heart of it. Why'd you pick a journalist?
For a number of reasons. One is that it's something I could personally relate to in terms of the writing that I've done and my life and people that I'm directly familiar with. But the other reason is that I wanted a character that sort of fell into a situation that he wasn't expecting. This is an individual who was a journalist in Cape Cod. His stories would not ever compare to stories that you'd find in a major metropolitan media outlet. The situation was much more tame. So he goes into something that forces him out of his comfort zone. But it also, the circumstances of this murder and of subsequent killings leads him to become very introspective, because he starts to uncover things about his own family, his own lineage, that he would not have found otherwise. And I thought that the vehicle of a journalist made that possible in a way that, with a detective, it might have seemed a bit contrived. I also wanted him to make mistakes. I wanted him to be someone who was not anticipating everything. It had a certain level of naivete. And that's essentially how we ended up doing that.
Bill, the story explores a lot of complexities within African-American communities in New England, and I'm assuming that's supposed to be sort of symbolizing nationwide as well. And I want to go back to what you said earlier about when you first came across Cape Verdean communities in the U.S., you didn't really know much about them. Can you tease apart what some of these tensions actually are, as well as complexities that aren't apparent to non-Black Americans, about the relations between African Americans and people of African heritage who have immigrated in more recent generations?
Well, it's a fascinating question, and we could have spent the entire interview on just that question.
Right. I mean, it sort of reminds me of that time when Barack Obama jumped into the national scene, and there was a big conversation about whether a half Kenyan American could be an African American.
Exactly. So let me say what struck me early on in the 1960s. Many of the people that I encountered called themselves Portuguese, and I looked at them, and they could have been as Black as coal. And I knew something about where Portugal was located. And so I said, Portuguese, what's this about? So one of the things was this, that the ancestors of the people that I met came here voluntarily. As I mentioned, many in the beginning as fishermen and whalers. And as Portuguese colonial subjects, they looked at African Americans in the United States as people who were the descendants of slaves. Well, the Cape Verdeans weren't the descendants of slaves. So one of the issues was trying to distinguish themselves from the descendants of slaves. They felt very proud that they hadn't themselves been slaves, and they wanted to distinguish themselves. So that got into this very odd situation where they would, in some cases, deny that they were Black. They would say, no, I'm not Negro, I'm not colored, I'm Portuguese. Or they might say that they were Cape Verdean, but but they often say they were Portuguese. There was also a tendency for many years to downplay tension that existed between Cape Verdeans and Portuguese in the United States. I had an experience in 1984, 85, when I went to New Bedford and interviewed some former retired longshoremen who were Cape Verdean. And they had been active in the 1930s and 1940s, and I asked them whether they had ever had any problems with whites. And they looked at me as if a horn had come out of my head. They was like, no. I mean, like, they looked at each other like, what are you talking about? And I asked them again, and they said, well, no, there were no problems. And then one of them said, you know, there were some problems with the Greenwood boys, but that was it. But they never explained what that was. A couple of years later, I was speaking with an iconic figure in the Cape Verdean community in New Bedford, a guy named Jack Custudio. And I told him the story. And he just broke into this incredible laugh. And he said, Bill, they didn't tell you who the Greenwood boys were, did they? And so I said, no. He said, they were the Portuguese. He said, these guys did not want to acknowledge that they weren't themselves Portuguese. They did not want to acknowledge the racial tensions because that would have then immediately put them in a category of being black. So this was really eye-opening. Now, on the other side, many African Americans, and it relates to your story about Obama, many African Americans who are the descendants of slaves or maybe the descendants of Caribbean people of African descent that migrated here can be fairly intolerant of those who they perceive as denying their blackness. So when you then have a Cape Verdean who wants to, with pride, uphold the fact that they are Cape Verdean, there are many African Americans say, well, no, you just want to deny that you're black. Now, in some cases, that was the case. In some cases, you had Cape Verdeans that wanted to deny that they were black, but not in all cases. And there was a way that many of us of African descent who are the descendants of slaves, we would be very intolerant of those that would say, well, you know, my lineage is a little bit more complicated. And it doesn't just collapse itself into being black. You see the same thing with immigrants of Afro-Latino immigrants who have a very different experience with white supremacy than we do in North America. They didn't have the one drop rule. You know, the one drop of African blood makes you black. In Latin America, you have this whole hierarchy of colors and based on intermixing that is an incredible means of social control. But it was different because of the larger numbers of people of African and Indian descent in Latin America. So here, you know, one of the things I'm trying to get at in the story is that the situation of who is black is very complicated. And how people chose to identify and why they made certain decisions and what did those decisions represent. The other factor with Cape Verdeans that is important to note is that the Portuguese and the French had this category known as assimilado. And the idea of it was that if a native, in this case, a Cape Verdean or someone from Guinea-Bissau or in the French-speaking areas of Guinea-Conakry or whatever else, if this native acted in a certain way, performed certain tasks, and proved themselves worthy, the colonial powers would grant them the status of being Portuguese or of being French. And it was elevating them into this quasi-elite. Well, this is very important in terms of the identity of a person when they're coming over to the United States and they see themselves in a certain way that doesn't correspond to the way that white supremacy operates in North America and the United States in particular.
Bill, there's also been a lot of interest in recent years among African Americans who can descend, trace their descent to enslaved Africans, and doing DNA tests, right? And exploring their heritage that way. Do you go into any of that in your book?
No, this was well before most of those tests, and I'm very ambivalent, by the way, about those tests. But that's another story. But this was before the tests, and what this deals much more with is skin color, and what that meant for how people saw themselves. Let me give you an example, just a personal, to give your listeners and viewers an idea of this. You see the way I look, and for those of you that are listening to this online, I'm light skinned, very light skinned. Now, I grew up with an identity as African American. I mean, it started with other terms, Negro, Afro American, whatever, but African American, black. But if I go to Latin America, I'm not necessarily viewed that way. If I go to Colombia, Venezuela, Brazil, and someone asks me, Bill, what are you? And I say, I'm black. They look at me cross-eyed. Whereas, as I like to say, if I fly into New York and I say I'm anything other than black, I'll be taken away in a straitjacket. So, how does one explain that? And you have to explain it by understanding history and the way that white supremacy operated in these different parts of the world. And so it played itself out differently in Latin America with something called Las Castas in both Spanish and Portuguese Latin America. And there was something within the Cape Verde, depending on what island you came from, there tended to be people that there was a there were shades of difference in skin color, depending on islands. And then you think about this a lot. So when people come over to the United States, they're bringing all of that in these different bags. They're bringing this heritage and this consciousness to the United States, and they land and they're dark, and someone says, you're black. And it's like, well, what does that mean? Or what can also happen is if they're light, then sort of a search for personal emancipation through greater and greater identification with the colonial oppressor.
Right, we have the some of the ways in which Americans think about race in literally black and white terms is quite unique to the United States and doesn't quite translate in the same way outside the United States. So much to talk about, and it's hard to encapsulate a murder mystery and a work of fiction in a short interview. So I certainly hope that listeners will pick up a copy of your book and read it themselves. Bill, I want to thank you so much for joining us, and I'm glad you were able to get this story out of you, and maybe there's more in the future.
Planning on working on a sequel this spring.
Oh, wonderful. Give out a
The
website.
response. Yes, you. Well, okay. So the book is published by Hardball Press, and it's available through Hardball Press or through Amazon. And my personal website is BillFletcherJr.com, and I'm also on Twitter and Facebook. And yeah, I'm hoping to do a sequel in the spring. The
Excellent.
responses to the book have been fantastic.
Great. Well, good luck and congratulations. Thanks so much, Bill.
Thank you, and take care.
My guest has been Bill Fletcher Jr., racial justice, labor, and international activist, former president of TransAfrica Forum, senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies, and an editorial board member of BlackCommentator.com. He's also the author of a number of nonfiction books, and we've been discussing his debut novel, The Man Who Fell from the Sky. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingup@sonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and now on Instagram at RU with Sonali.